Okay, and we'll pass around the attendance sheet, and we will get started with the great Daniel. Okay, well, who wrote the book of Daniel?
Daniel.
That's an easy answer. Okay. A little bit about Daniel. Daniel and three friends who are in the book of Daniel. I'm sure he had more than three, but the three particular friends were born into the royal family of Judah. We don't know exactly how they were related to the king, but in some way they were part of the royal family. When they were very young, they were part of the group that Nebuchadnezzar's army transported from the land of Israel to the land of Babylon, and they became exiles in Babylon. And they spent 3 years training in the very best schools in Babylon. But Daniel, not just because of his education, but because of the blessing of God in his life, Daniel had wisdom, not just knowledge, but he had wisdom. And on top of that, God gave him the ability to interpret dreams, which was very important to the Babylonians. And this is going to be a key to get Daniel into a very important position. He served a long time. He served during the reigns of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Darius, and Cyrus, which is quite a record. By the way, Daniel is one of the few characters in the Bible of whom we know nothing negative. You will not find any sin, although he was a sinner, definitely sinned, we know, but there's no account of his sin, no account of any failure on his part, absolutely nothing negative about this. He wrote his own book under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Right, okay. I used to say, well, I won't say it. No. I used to say when I was single that he's also apparently not married. Maybe that's an explanation for his never sinning or getting into trouble, but I don't say that anymore. Okay. He was characterized by faith, prayer, courage, and a lack of compromise. What a man. What a man of God. Now, you'll see the date here, probably completed around 530 BC. Now, some have argued that the historical character Daniel, the historical man Daniel, did not write the book. And the reason they don't want to acknowledge that Daniel wrote the book is because in the book, there are a lot of prophecies of some events that happened within 200 years of his life. And they don't want to acknowledge that that is the miraculous hand of God. They are so detailed, some of the most detailed prophecies you have anywhere in the Bible are these prophecies that Daniel made of events that would happen within 200 years of his lifetime. And so the critics don't want to acknowledge the supernatural, don't want to acknowledge that God can do that, give that to him. And so they say, oh, it must have been written by someone after those events who claimed to be Daniel writing. But then they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of them were written, I'm not talking about the copies of Scripture, but I'm talking about the parts of the Dead Sea Scrolls that are commentaries on Scripture and things like that. Some of those were written before these events were fulfilled, and it's obvious that the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls knew and believed that Daniel wrote the book. Some of the critics argue that in the second century, or how should I put it? Some people argue that Daniel made some mistakes in some of the things that he said concerning what's going to happen and so on. And they say, for instance, he calls Belshazzar the king. And some of the critics have jumped on that and said, well, Belshazzar at that time was not the king. But then inscriptions have been found that show that Belshazzar at that time was reigning in Babylon. Even though his father was still living, he was a co-regent, it's called. And so there's no problem with calling Nebuchadnezzar the king. Some critics have said, since part of the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic, most of the Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew. But there are a few chapters in Daniel that were written in Aramaic. Aramaic is a language very similar to Hebrew, but it is different. And so some people have looked at this Aramaic and have said, well, we don't think that the Aramaic words that Daniel uses and some of the expressions were in use when you say Daniel wrote. But then in recent days, people have found out that Daniel's Aramaic is actually a form of what's called Imperial Aramaic that was used in the royal palace during the time when the historical Daniel was living. So every argument that the critics have made against the authorship of Daniel keeps crumbling. And so I think we can be very certain that Daniel was the human author. The theme has a very important theme, and that is God's sovereignty. It's throughout the book, but especially it is in chapter 5, verse 21. The Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets up over it whom he will. That is over and over, not those words, but that concept is over and over and over again in the book of Daniel. That it is God who is sovereign and God rules the kingdoms and God sets up kings and he takes down kings. And that particular verse, chapter 5, verse 21, the context of that verse we're going to get into was that incident of the writing, handwriting on the wall, remember? At Belshazzar's feast. And what a time when Belshazzar was so lifted up in pride and felt that he was invincible. And then here that message gets written by this hand that's not connected to the rest of a body, just written some fingers writing on the wall, telling Belshazzar his time is up. And he's not going to be the emperor anymore. And that very night, unbeknownst to him, the Medo-Persian Empire was about to march into the city and conquer him and kill him. And in that context, Daniel makes this statement about the sovereignty of God. And now, Daniel writes this book with this emphasis on the sovereignty of God to encourage the Jewish people, because this was a period where so many of the Jewish people were in captivity in Babylon. The ones back home in Israel were absolutely devastated with the destruction of the land and the destruction of the temple. And here comes along this book that emphasizes the sovereignty of God. You can trust in God. And becomes a very, very important theme for them. Now you'll notice Christ in Daniel, as we have Christ in every book of the Bible. First of all, we have Christ in the great stone who will crush the kingdoms of the world. That's in Nebuchadnezzar's dream that we're going to get into in chapter 2. In that dream, he's going to have a statue that's going to represent the world empires from his empire on. And then all of a sudden, there's this stone that comes down and smashes it to smithereens. And that stone then becomes a great mountain. And that is a prophecy of the kingdom of Messiah that will crush all the kingdoms of men. Christ is also here. Christ is the Son of Man who gives dominion, who is given dominion by the Ancient of Days. That's in chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, where it uses the expression Son of Man as a title for Messiah and is part of the reason Son of Man was the title that Jesus most often used of himself. And it goes back to the book of Daniel. Then number three, Christ is in Daniel because we have the vision of the 69 weeks, part of the 70 weeks vision that we're going to see later on tonight. And that vision pinpoints the coming of the Messiah, even down to the day that he entered into Jerusalem on what we call Palm Sunday. Well, let's get into the book. There's, you know, it's one of those books that we could be here all week studying. We won't because we're getting a bird's eye view, but it's going to be a challenge just to keep it down to an hour. So let's look at it. First of all, in this outline by Ray Steadman, we have the first part of the book, The Life of Daniel in Babylon, and that's in chapter 1. So let's read from chapter 1 in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 1. Book begins, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Verse 3, then the king commanded Ashpenaz, the chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom. So they wanted some of the choice young men from Israel. They looked sharp. They looked kingly. They had bright minds. And these are to be people endowed with wisdom, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. So they sent them to school to be immersed, as it were, in the Babylonian or Chaldean, that's another term for Babylonian, culture. Now, Ashpenaz is called here in verse 3 his chief eunuch. And then later on, it's going to be referred to that he's in charge of the king's eunuchs. And since Daniel is going to be part of this group, that has caused some people to assume that Daniel was castrated and became a eunuch. That's not necessarily true because, although originally the term eunuch did refer to someone who was castrated, later on, by the time of Daniel, it was a term that was used of court officials in the court and did not necessarily mean that they had been castrated. So here they are, and in verse 5, the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank, which most people would be very grateful for. Instead of having bread and water like a slave, they're in the palace. They're getting the best steak and the best wine. And they were to be educated for 3 years. And at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. Everyone's heard of Daniel. A lot of people would say they've never heard of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Well, everyone has, because we were used to calling them by their Babylonian names. And so in verse 7, the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. It's just one of those things I don't quite understand, why we all know the other three by their Babylonian names, but not Daniel. I wish we knew them all, like Daniel, by their Hebrew names. And what's going on here? This is part of the brainwashing of the Babylonians, getting them into their culture, trying to get them out of Jewish culture. And one of the things to do that is to change the name. Not just like we would do, just because a name is a good-sounding name, but our name might sound American compared to Chinese, let's say. That's not it, because the names in those days meant something, and everyone knew what the name meant. So in the case of Daniel, his Hebrew name, Daniel, you see the letters E-L on the end, that's the Hebrew word for God. The name means God is my judge. They changed it to Belteshazzar, which means Bel, who was the name of one of their false gods. Bel protects his life. So they gave him a heathen name connected with their religion. Then Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Hananiah means the Lord shows grace. It was a good Jewish name referring to the God of Israel. They changed it to Shadrach, which means command of Aku. Aku was the moon god. So again, giving him a name connected with heathenism. Mishael means who is like God. And they changed his name to Meshach, which is from their language means who is as Aku is, who is as the moon god is. And then Azariah, good Jewish name that means the Lord is my help, they changed to Abednego, which means servant of Nebo, Nebo being another pagan god. So you can see what they've done here. Well, then in verse 8, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Now, what was defiling to Daniel about eating the Babylonian meat and food and drinking their wine? These were not prepared according to the rules in the Old Testament law that God had given the Jewish people. We call those the kosher laws. Although today the kosher laws extend to a lot more than just the rules that God had given the Jewish people in the law. Today, you know, they've expanded it to you can't wash vessels that have been used for dairy products in the same sink with the meat products and all that. Now, Daniel wasn't involved with that. But what he was involved with was you could not eat unclean animals. You could only eat the clean animals. You could not eat animals that had not had all of the blood drained out. And these things the Babylonians just didn't do. So it is that sense in which Daniel would defile himself spiritually before his God if he ate their food. Some people have taken this way beyond anything that it should be by saying it was simply if he ate meat, he would defile himself. Trying to the Seventh-day Adventists, for instance, will point to this verse as saying it's defiling to eat meat. And that wasn't the point. It was that it was not according to God's rules about how the meat should be done. So verse 9, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. So God was at work with this. And God just moved on the heart of Ashpenaz just to look with favor on Daniel and his three friends. And so the rest of the chapter goes with what happened. They are allowed to not eat the king's food and to have this special diet. And lo and behold, when it came time to check out to all of these men who followed God's way, wound up looking far healthier and better than the others. And it was part of God's separating them from the others. And they're going to be in great places of authority. Verse 21 is an important verse in the flow of the book in that it says, Daniel was there, that is, he was there in Babylon until the first year of King Cyrus. That means Daniel served in Babylon, served the kings, 3 years of education, and then serving, the total of education and serving, 65 years. That was a long time in those days. He would have been undoubtedly 80, beyond 80 at the end. And he still lived a few years after this. But that's how long he served. Well, turning the page, we then have the next part of the book, which details God's plan for the Gentiles. So now we get into prophecy, which most of the book is prophecy. Number one, Daniel interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the great image. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Let's look at that in chapter 2, verse 1. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. He had this dream, and apparently he believed that it contained a message for him, because the Babylonians were very big on the gods would give messages to them in dreams, and so it was important to interpret dreams and so on. And he seemed to realize that there was a significant message for him in this dream. And in the dream, he sees this massive image that he probably identified that image as being representative of him. And that massive image winds up being smashed. And he begins to become concerned. What does this mean? Does this mean something is going to happen to me and my kingdom? Well, what the dream means is that God is in control of history. And that is the lesson. And that nothing takes God by surprise. So he has the dream. And in the dream, there's this great image. And the image has a head of gold. And I should back up and say that Nebuchadnezzar called for his dream interpreters and his wise men and so on to come and give him the interpretation. But he wasn't going to he wasn't going to give them any advantages, and such as he wasn't going to tell them what the dream actually looked like. He was going to see if they could tell him that. If they can't tell him what he actually dreamed, they could certainly never tell him what it meant. And so he puts them to the test. He's not going to tell them what the actual dream was. They're going to have to tell him. Now, some people have had divided opinions on, had he forgotten the dream, and is that why he told the wise men, you're going to have to tell me what the dream was, or was he testing them? I think he was testing them. And so tell me the dream, and then what it means, and if you can't do it, death to you, which was how they did things in those days. Well, Daniel and his three friends are included in that group. They're under the death sentence. And Daniel and his friends turned to God in prayer and asked for God to intervene and give the interpretation. And God gives the information to Daniel of what the dream was and how to interpret it. So Daniel comes and tells the king, yes, remember the dream was this great image and it had a head of gold. And first he'll go through and describe the image, and then in the chapter he goes through and tells what the different parts meant. That's the part that Nebuchadnezzar didn't know. It says the image has a head of gold. That head of gold represents you, King Nebuchadnezzar, and your empire. Then the image had a chest and arms of silver. That represents the kingdom that's going to come after you, which is in history called the Medo-Persian Persian Empire. It was made up of the Medes and the Persians, and represented by the two different arms, and yet connected in the chest. It was one empire with these two different parts. Then the middle and thighs of bronze represents the kingdom that's going to conquer the Medo-Persian Empire, and that is the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great. Then the image has legs, of course, and the legs are made of iron, and that is going to represent the empire that's going to conquer Rome, or is going to conquer Greece, which is going to be the Roman Empire. And then, after it has its two legs, which, of course, we all know the Roman Empire divided in two, remember, eventually, the Eastern and Western. But then it has feet. And the feet have toes, and there happen to be 10 toes. And the feet and the toes are made partly of iron and partly of clay. So something significant here with the value of the elements making up the statue, the image, the most valuable being gold, little less value is silver, and then there's bronze, and then there's iron, and then there's iron mixed with clay. And that's a picture of the deterioration of civilization and mankind. From this great empire of Babylon, and there just comes more and more corruption all the way down to the feet with the toes. Now, significant 10 toes. The feet and the clay, the feet made of iron and clay coming out of Rome, are another empire which we commonly call in Bible prophecy the revised Roman Empire. And so what you have here is the Roman Empire, of course, was in power at the time of the coming of Christ. And after the coming of Christ, of course, it left the scene. And we've had these 2,000 years since the coming of Christ, which is in several places in prophecy a big parenthesis, because the prophecy has to do with God's time clock for Israel. But right now, after the rejection of the Messiah and his ascension to heaven, now we are dealing with the church. But there's coming a day when God's prophetic clock will start ticking again. We're going to have the timing of that in chapter 9. And at the time that clock starts ticking, there's going to be another empire on the scene that we call the revised Roman Empire, revived Roman Empire, with these 10 toes. There are other prophecies in Daniel and Revelation that talk about this empire comes to being as a confederation of 10 states or 10 nations. In the area that used to be the Roman Empire. But that's getting into other prophecies. But this is the heart of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Then he has this huge stone in the dream, comes out of heaven, and it lands on the feet of the image. So timing-wise, this is a prophecy that this great stone hasn't come yet, because it's going to come during the time of the revived Roman Empire. And when it comes, it's going to smash to smithereens that kingdom, but the whole statue is going to come tumbling down. And then this great mountain is going to grow, which is a prophecy of the coming kingdom of Jesus Christ. So God, Christ's kingdom replaces the kingdoms of this world. So all of that is prophesied and pictured in this dream that Nebuchadnezzar has in chapter 2. That brings us to number 2, Nebuchadnezzar's image of gold. And that's in chapter 3. Where do you think Nebuchadnezzar got the idea to build a mammoth statue. I think it probably was from the dream. Only this time, he makes the whole statue gold instead of just the head. And probably it's a statue represented, picturing himself. It's probably sculpted in his image. Now, when you read the chapter and you see how tall it was, people have presumed that that dimension of the height includes the pedestal that it sits on. But anyway, he erects this great, massive statue out on the plain there, a place where there's plenty of room for everyone to come. And then he has a band and an orchestra. And he gives the command that when they start to play, everyone is to bow down and worship the image. Now, there's three people who won't do it. They are, with their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Some people say, well, what about Daniel? We can be sure he wouldn't bow down. He's never mentioned. But by the time you get to chapter 3, Daniel is exceedingly high in authority under Nebuchadnezzar in the kingdom. We assume he was out of town on business. For whatever reason, he's not around when this happens. But the decree had been that anyone that would not bow down and worship the statue would be cast alive into the fiery furnace. And you know the story. Of that's exactly what they did with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're cast into the fiery furnace. It is made so hot that the workers who throw them in die because it is just that hot. And yet Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come out alive. But on top of that, Nebuchadnezzar looks in and he says, not only do I see them walking, but there's a fourth man. And the fourth man looks like a son of the gods. And it's one of the remarkable stories of the Bible. And the book of Hebrews in chapter 11 on the account of the heroes of faith is going to talk about some who went through the fiery furnace. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they came out alive. And what a story of their courage and their non-compromising, but also the power of God. And the story has been put into a Southern Gospel song called The Fourth Man in the Fire. And this a child is asking in the song his parent, well, where did the fourth man go? And the parent answers, he's still in the fire with all of his people as they're going through the fire. You know, and that's a good analogy, that he goes with us through the fire as well. Well, that's chapter 3. Then we have number 3. Daniel interprets Nebuchadnezzar's vision of a great tree. Chapter 4 is a very unique chapter in the Bible because it actually is not written by Daniel. Daniel includes it in his book, but it's written by King Nebuchadnezzar. And King Nebuchadnezzar gives his testimony. I believe we will see Nebuchadnezzar in heaven. This tyrant who destroyed Jerusalem. And yet I believe this chapter shows that towards the end of his life, he came to trust in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It is quite a chapter and quite a story. It begins, let's look at it, chapter 4, Daniel chapter 4. And verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar, introducing himself as the author. to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. Peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. And again, he has a dream. And he tells the story here about he had this dream of this great tree and what happened to it, and he didn't know what it meant. And Daniel comes and he interprets the dream. And the bottom line of interpreting the dream is that Nebuchadnezzar is a king highly exalted in pride, thinks highly of himself, but God is going to humble him, even to the point that he is going to become insane. He doesn't use the word insanity in here. They didn't use that word then, but we know that, that's in effect what it's describing. He's going to think and act like an animal, a wild animal. And he's going to just be out roaming as a wild animal, letting his fingernails grow, and they're going to become like claws, and his hair grow, and so on. He is going to be a mess. But then he's going to come to his senses, and he's going to humble himself before God and trust God. Look at the end of the chapter after seeing the beginning of the chapter. Look down in verses 36 and 37. Verse 36, at the same time, my reason returned to me. As for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Daniel, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven. That, of course, is the God of Israel. And I didn't take time to read, but in verse 34, 30, and 35, he speaks of the King of heaven. For all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. And Nebuchadnezzar says, I know what that's like. And I've been humbled, and I now submit myself to him. Remarkable, remarkable story. That brings us to number 4 on the outline, Belshazzar, the handwriting on the wall, and Daniel's interpretation. That's in chapter 5. This is the famous incident of the handwriting on the wall, which that expression, handwriting on the wall, has come down in our culture. And there's probably plenty of people who have heard that expression and maybe used it who have no idea where it comes from. But it comes from the Bible. It comes from Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar is a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, sitting on Nebuchadnezzar's throne now. Nebuchadnezzar's long dead. And he's lifted up in pride. He has this drunken banquet. And he brings in many of the vessels that were stolen from the temple in Jerusalem, and people are using them at this banquet and getting drunk and so on. And all of a sudden, this hand not connected to an arm, just the hand and fingers, comes, and the fingers right on the wall, something that Belshazzar and his men don't have a clue what it's saying. And he says, who can interpret this? And his mother remembers Daniel and talks about Daniel and to bring him in, and he can do it, of course, by God's power. And so Daniel explains what those words are, mini, mini, tiko, upharsin, in Aramaic, and then he explains what they mean. Turn to chapter 5, verse 25. And this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, You have been weighed in the balances and found waiting or wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then Belshazzar gave command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Why not number two? Because Belshazzar's number two. Remember that thing from the critics accusing the book of not being accurate in calling Belshazzar the king? Well, he was a co-regent with the king. His father, Nabonidus, is still the king, but is off somewhere else, and he left Belshazzar as the king of Babylon. But technically, Belshazzar's number two, and so he makes Daniel number three. But verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. What happened? History tells us what happened, that the Medo-Persian Empire was coming against Babylon. Babylon didn't think it was possible that they could be conquered. But what they didn't know was that that night, because there was a river, the river Euphrates ran through the city of Babylon. And when it got to Babylon, it went in a channel underneath the wall and then through the city and then in a channel underneath the other side of the city. And what the Medes and Persians did was, upstream, they stopped the flow of the water. And then that night, they just walked through that big ditch underneath the wall. They knew where the palace was. They came to the palace, and they killed the king and undoubtedly many other people too. And the Medo-Persian Empire now was in control. And that message to Belshazzar was, your days are numbered, and you're going to be conquered. And that's exactly what happened. Well, that brings us to number five. Darius, the new king under the Medes and Persians, deceived Daniel, and Daniel saved in the lion's den. And that's in chapter 6. Turn to chapter 6, verses 4 and 5. When it says that Darius is deceived, he seems to be kind of pleased with how the kingdom's going, and you have all these officials doing very well, but some of the officials are jealous of Daniel, and so in chapter 6, verse 4, then the presidents and satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful. Wouldn't that be great to have that said of us as well? Can find no fault in him or her because they are faithful. No error or fault was found in him. Verse 5. And these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. They said the only blot we can find on him would be his keeping the commandments of his God. Now, that's not a blot as far as God's concerned, not a blot as far as the Jewish people are concerned, but it would be a blot concerning some of the Babylonians and Medo-Persians. So they deceived the king by boosting his ego and saying, you know, you are so great and you're the only one to be worshipped. How about let's make a law saying that prayer can only be offered to you? The king swallowed it, hook, line, and sinker. And so he makes that law. Well, guess who's not going to pray to him? It's Daniel. And Daniel followed the Old Testament procedures of prayer, morning prayers, afternoon prayers, evening prayers. It was the time of the morning and afternoon and evening sacrifices at the temple in Jerusalem. Even though the temple's gone, Daniel still followed that. And he would go into his house, open the windows, and bow and face Jerusalem as he prayed. Did it every day. And sure enough, after the law was made, he still did it. And so they arrested him, and the penalty had been put into the law to be thrown into a den of lions. And you know the story of how that happened to Daniel. Some people said, well, maybe the lions weren't hungry. Maybe that's why they didn't eat him. Well, later on at the end of the story, when Daniel comes out of that alive, the king's going to throw those people that conspired against him in, and those lions are going to be right there to kill them, eat them instantly. So it's not that they weren't hungry. God gave them lockjaw or something. And he came out of there just like Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, out of the fire, unharmed. Growing up as a boy, my parents had a little picture on my wall in my bedroom of Daniel standing in front of the lions. And the lions are just cowering, you know, in the back as Daniel is standing there. That's a good picture in a boy's room to remind them to be like Daniel. Then we come to number 6, Daniel's vision of the four beasts. In this vision, Daniel learned about 6 different kingdoms. 4 were kingdoms of the world. 1 is the kingdom of the future Antichrist. And the last one is the kingdom of the Messiah. And with the animals, you have the lion with the wings of an eagle. And that represents Babylon. That's in chapter 7, verse 4. Then you have the next animal on the scene is a bear with 3 ribs in its mouth. And the bear is leaning towards one side. That's chapter 7, verse 5. That represents the empire of the Medes and Persians that conquered Babylon. Leaning to one side, even though it's made up of Medes and Persians, it leaned towards the Persians. And it has 3 ribs in its mouth. And those ribs stand for Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon, nations that the Medes and the Persians had conquered. The next animal is a leopard with 4 wings. So the picture there, leopards, of course, are the fastest animal. And then on top of that, it has wings to make it even faster. Represents the coming empire of Greece, led by Alexander the Great, who is known by the speed with which he conquered the world. And that was prophesied here before it ever happened. And then there is what's called the terrifying and dreadful beast. And that represents the Roman Empire. And this beast has 10 horns. So that again, just like the first image had 10 toes, so this beast has 10 horns. And there's going to be connection with prophecy in the book of Revelation concerning 10 different things several times, all relating to this future form of the Roman Empire. And out of those 10 horns, there's going to come growing up a little horn who is going to take down 3 of those 10 horns. In other words, he's going to consolidate his power. That is a prophecy of the future Antichrist kingdom over the revived Roman Empire. And so Antichrist is pictured here, is going to have a kingdom. Other prophecies are going to go into detail that he's going to make a covenant with Israel for 7 years, but he's going to break it in the halfway point, 3.5 years into those 7 years. And that's going to usher in the great tribulation. 7 years of tribulation, but the last 3.5 years, the Great Tribulation. But following that is the last kingdom, which is the kingdom of Christ. So those chapters talk about God's plan primarily for the Gentiles. Now we have the next part of the book, the last part, God's plan for Israel. And you have number 7, Daniel's vision of the ram and the goat. And the ram is a picture in this vision of King Cyrus, the king of Persia. The Persian Empire will conquer Babylon and did conquer Babylon. Then Alexander the Great is the goat. But then there is another one who comes on the scene who is following in the line of Alexander the Great, who's prophesied here, and his name is Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. And what's going to happen is Alexander the Great is going to die unexpectedly, very young, while he's in the midst of all his conquering. His empire is going to be divided up among his 4 generals. 2 of those generals and their descendants are going to constantly be at war over the little land of Israel. You have the general Ptolemy, who's going to have control of Egypt, and you have the general Seleucus, who's going to have control of Syria, and in between Syria and Egypt is Israel. And they are constantly going to be clashing. And so chapter 8 begins this section, which is talking about God's plan for Israel. It begins to have a whole bunch of prophecies of what's going to happen when this clash happens over a period of a couple of hundred years. It's going to be, time-wise, in the 400 years between the close of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And you're going to have the Ptolemies and the Seleucids clashing. One of the Seleucids is going to be this man, Antiochus Epiphanes. And he is going to be a tyrant. He is going to be kind of a foretelling, you might say, of Antichrist. Everything that Antiochus Epiphanes was to Israel, Antichrist will be even more so. And so we don't have time to read it, but in chapter 8, verses 9 to 14, the prophecies are of this coming tyrant named Antiochus Epiphanes. Then in chapter 8, verses 23 to 27, the prophecy shifts to what is still future for us, which is prophecies of the Antichrist. Turning the page, that sets the stage for the most, we could honestly say, the most significant chapter in the book of Daniel, and that is chapter 9, Daniel's vision of the 70 weeks. Now, what's happening here in chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, Daniel is wanting to learn God's plan. And Daniel has the book of Jeremiah. And in Jeremiah, he sees that prophecy that the children of Israel are going to be in bondage in Babylon for 70 years. And he knows that it's almost up. And he is praying and he's concerned about what's going to happen to Israel. And he's seeking to know more. God answers that desire with this prophecy of the 70 weeks. He begins to pray for God's mercy in verses 3 to 19. And then beginning in verse 20, God begins to give him instruction concerning what's going to happen to Israel. And the instruction is in the form of a prophecy about what is called 70 weeks. Now, he's already tuned in to 70 because he knows the prophecy of the 70 years, which is about to be fulfilled. It's almost time for those 70 years to be over and the Jews to go back to Jerusalem. So then God says, well, I want to tell you about another time frame, and that is 70 weeks. Now, the 70 weeks gets a little confusing because the Hebrew word for weeks doesn't necessarily mean 7 days. It's a word like our word dozen. If I say 10 dozen, you don't know. Is it a dozen, 10 dozen years, 10 dozen cars, 10 dozen people? It's just a dozen. Well, that's this Hebrew word that is translated weeks. It's a 7. Well, when you delve into it, you discover that he's talking about 70 sevens of years. So that's a period of 490 years. So there's this prophecy of something that's going to happen to Israel over a period of 490 years. Now, he's going to divide up those years. He's going to talk about a period of 62 plus 7, so that makes 69. So that's 483 years. And the prophecy is going to be that from the time this time clock begins, and you count from that day for 483 years, then God's anointed, the Messiah, the Prince, is going to come, and he's going to be cut off. The term cut off means to be killed. So it's a prophecy of the coming of the Messiah, and then that he is going to be killed 483 years after this prophecy gets started. Now he identifies when those years are going to start, and that is with a decree that comes from Artaxerxes for rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. And we know when that day was in history, and you count 483 years, and you even count precisely how many days are in a year. Well, in their year, it was 360. And you do it even by day times 360 times 483 from that day that we have the historical pinpoint of the day when that decree was made, and you come to the day when Jesus entered into Jerusalem on what we call Palm Sunday. And then, after he comes as Messiah, within a week of that, he is cut off. He is killed. Then the prophecy deals with the last of the 7 weeks. In other words, a last period of 7 years. But what's not visible in the prophecy is that there is a parenthesis between the 69th year and the beginning of the 7th group of 7 years. That parenthesis is explained to us in the New Testament. It's what we call the church age. And when the church age comes to its end, then God's time clock for Israel will start ticking again. And it will start ticking with the beginning of the tribulation, which is how many years? 7 years. And that is prophesied here. So 70 years, 70 times 7, 490 years. First 483 years cover from that decree to the coming of Messiah. And we are waiting for the clock to tick off the last 7 years, which will be that 7 years of tribulation for Israel. So it is an amazing prophecy. Well, I have to finish the book, and then that's number 9, Daniel's interpretation of the vision, chapters 10 to 12, Daniel's vision of the strange messenger. Daniel is in prayer. Now, all of this is just really an amazing set of circumstances. Chapter 10 is connected with chapter 9. God sends an angel to an answer to Daniel's prayer. But Daniel keeps waiting and waiting and waiting for 3 weeks. And then the angel comes and says, God sent me right after you prayed, but I was hindered by the prince of Persia. Now, this is an angel. The prince of Persia is not a human. The prince of Persia is a demon. And the Bible talks about the demons being principalities and powers. And that term can also refer to human leaders. And so we just have a little opening of the curtain there to see this concept that just as there are earthly kingdoms with earthly rulers, so Satan has his kingdom with his rulers. And so evidently Satan has a demon who is considered the prince of Persia. Presumably he has a demon who would be the prince of the United States, prince of Russia. And they are in conflict with God's angels. Of course, we don't know much about that. We just have a few little glimpses in Scripture. And here is one of them. Then, the first 69 weeks, chapter 11, verses 1 to 35. Here is that amazing chapter. It has over 100 prophecies of specific events that are going to happen in those first 483 years. Mostly that period between the close of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And sometime do a study of those. It is a phenomenal study to see the prophecy and how it was fulfilled. I mean, they are so detailed. Then see the 70th week, which is the tribulation. So this part of the prophecy is prophecy of the coming Antichrist and the time of tribulation. And then D, sealing of the scroll and the final words on the time of the tribulation. In these verses, kind of interesting, Daniel and his immediate readers aren't going to be able to understand all of this. And God speaks about the scroll being sealed. And they just don't understand. But as time goes on, people will understand more. We, because of living where we are, seeing these kingdoms that have come, we have an understanding of those prophecies in a way that Daniel and his contemporaries never did. Well, that, in a nutshell, is the book of Daniel. And of course, Bob, not very long ago, taught Daniel in detail on Tuesday nights, and that is a great, great study. It's worth its weight and gold to go through the book of Daniel in detail. Well, next week we go to begin with the minor prophets, with the first one being Hosea. And Hosea, what a story of Hosea and his prophecy. But next week, any prayer requests that we have to